Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and joining us now, I'm very pleased to have in our studio Jared Diamond, the Pulitzer Prize-winning and best-selling author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, and UCLA geography professor. He's here with his new book about what the few remaining tribes and nomad groups in the world have to teach us in modern societies. It's called The World Until Yesterday: What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? And a lot of it is based on his 40-plus years of field experience in New Guinea. Welcome back to WNYC, Professor Diamond. So good to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And first of all, what do you mean by traditional societies? I have a feeling the average listener conjures up one thing, and maybe or maybe it isn't what you mean.
Traditional societies mean all of these small-scale tribal societies, which met everybody in the world until the first centralized state government arose about 5,000 years ago. And there are still lots of traditional societies left. New Guinea and the Amazon are full of them. But even within the United States, rural areas of Montana and Vermont, while there's a state government there, there's a lot that is still traditional.
And so when you say that states only emerged 5,000 years ago, sounds like a long time, but of course it's no time compared to the millions of years that human beings lived in traditional societies. And you believe, relevant to this, that people are not basically the same everywhere now. Is that an important idea?
It's interesting. They're not basically the same. They are basically the same. When I first went out to New Guinea in 1964, I was naive and I knew that they had stone tools and I thought they'd be exotic and could read minds and all sorts of other stuff. And then my first impression was they're the same. I mean, they laugh, they make jokes, their children play, they cry, they find funny the same things that I. And then as the years went on, I discovered that they're really different from me about some basic things like friendship and getting married and how they raise children and treat their old people. So the fascinating thing about traditional societies is they're similar, we can understand them, and they're different.
And listeners, if you want an opportunity to talk to Jared Diamond, you can call in right now. Maybe you have a connection to the kind of traditional societies, one of them that he's talking about, or maybe you just have a question. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And let's get into one of these differences, the area of violence and conflict resolution. You write that, ironically, given a 20th century of atomic bombs and concentration camps, that the level of violence in traditional society is on average higher than in modern state-level societies. What is that? How do you measure it?
You measure it by the percentage of people whose deaths are due to violence and war rather than dying in bed or dying of diseases. And the cruel reality is that even if you compare the worst of the worst of the 20th century, Poland, Germany, and Russia during World War II, a higher percentage of people in traditional tribal societies die violent deaths than in state-level societies. And the reason is that a state can not only declare war but make peace and enforce the peace, whereas a tribal society, there are the young hotheads who are not satisfied with the peace agreement, want to resume war, and without a centralized government, you can't restrain them.
And yet you say that modern societies could learn a thing or two about conflict resolution from traditional ones.
That's true, because in traditional societies, when there's a conflict, it's when there's a dispute, it's not that they immediately go to war. Of course, they try to settle the dispute peacefully, and the ways that they settle the dispute are wonderful compared to our court system. The goal in conflict resolution in a traditional society is to achieve emotional clearance and reestablish a peaceful relationship between the parties for the rest of their lives, whereas in our court system, when a couple are divorcing or when there's an inheritance dispute, the last thing that the courts care about is reestablishing a good relationship. The court cares about right and wrong, but the tribes don't care about that.
And you write in the book that the goals of conflict resolution in traditional societies are different, as you were just explaining, than the goals of a modern justice system. And it seems that the traditional societies either resolve conflicts absolutely in some of your examples, there's full compensation and a peaceful restoration of the breached relationship, or they engage in violent revenge, sometimes to the death.
You've got it. It's polarized. It's either much better or much worse than with us. The first effort is to achieve a resolution that leaves you satisfied, even if, as in a case that I encountered, something awful happens. So a child got killed. And incredibly, 5 days after the death of the child in a car accident, the employer and the colleagues of the driver sat down with the mother and father and uncles of the dead boy, and they cried together, and it was all settled. Imagine that in the United States. But if that doesn't work, then it goes to the opposite extreme, which is horrible, which is war.
So if the subtitle of the book is What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies, is that are some of the examples of horrible violence in other countries that are in the news right now, you know, applicable to learning lessons, whether it's the horrible gang rape of the 23-year-old med student in New Delhi, which we just had a previous segment on, the massacre of the 26 people, including the 20 children in Newtown, Connecticut, the 38% uptick of murders in Chicago last year. We could go on and on with things from the news. But are there lessons from traditional groups that are practically applicable to modern societies?
Yes, there are lessons, and that is that if there's a dispute, even if it's something horrible about somebody getting killed, it's not enough to determine right or wrong and send someone to jail, because then the victims and the relatives of the victims are left with these tortured feelings for the rest of their lives. There's a program in the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, the U.K. called restorative justice, in which if people are willing, you bring together the victim or the victim's relatives and the perpetrator so that they can understand themselves as people and get some emotional clearance rather than being tortured for their lives.
Whereas our justice system literally views crimes as not primarily crimes against the victim in a legal sense, but crimes against the state. The victim cannot settle with the perpetrator without the state getting involved if there's a criminal attack, for example.
That's correct. And even worse than that, when the state does get involved, the state doesn't care whether the victim still harbors miserable feelings for the rest of the world. For example, a friend of mine, 60 years ago, his sister was murdered by robbers, and the robbers were sent to jail. But that doesn't achieve emotional clearance for my friend. What would have achieved emotional clearance was if the robbers were willing, being brought face to face with them, discharging his feelings, understanding how they did this, and that actually happens sometimes under restorative justice.
Jared Diamond with us on WNYC. His new book, The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies, 212-433-WNYC. And Hank in Westchester, you're on the air. Hank, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. I'd like you to elaborate, if you would, on the traditional societies that you mentioned in Vermont and Montana, how you found them, and if you could elaborate on the nature of their society, the basis of their communal relationships.
I knew we'd get a call like this once you mentioned modern U.S. examples. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Hank. It just came up because I was just talking with someone from rural Vermont, and my wife and I and kids spend our vacations at a rural part of Montana. Montana and Vermont have state government. There are police. There are justice systems. But in Montana, if my rancher friend has a dispute with a neighboring rancher, my rancher friend doesn't immediately call in the lawyer and go to the police, because my rancher friend knows that he or she is going to have to get along with that neighbor for the next 60 years. So there's an emphasis on trying to settle the dispute in a way that gets emotional clearance in the traditional tribal ways that we've had for hundreds of thousands of years, rather than calling in the cops and having punishment.
Different than in the atomized culture of a city.
Different from in the atomized culture of Los Angeles and New York.
You have a chapter called Constructive Paranoia, and you tell a couple of stories about how New Guineans approach risk. Can you tell the story about your canoe capsizing and what you learned about this, quote, constructive paranoia?
I've had some bad experiences in New Guinea, which included a canoe capsizing, and I nearly ended up drowned. We got rescued 15 minutes before sunset, And if we had not been rescued, then I wouldn't be here talking with you. I learned from that and other experiences and from observing New Guineans to be ultra careful and to think about what really are the dangers in life. So what are the dangers in American life? They're not terrorists and airplane crashes we obsess about. Today, Brian, I've already had the most dangerous experience that I'll have all day today.
Uh-oh.
I took a shower. And you may say, what on earth about taking a shower? Well, the fact is, you read the obituary columns, one of the common causes of either death or crippling for old people is slipping in the shower. Now, you may say, my risk of slipping in the shower is 1 in 1,000, but I intend to take more than 1,000 showers in the remainder of my life, and I got to be really careful if I don't want my life ended or crippled through a fall in the shower.
And related, you tell a story about deciding with your Ghanaian companions whether to pitch a tent near a dead tree. And they were opposed because they're afraid of the tree falling in the night. You thought they were being too cautious and paranoid. But did that teach you something about how modern societies approach risk in comparison to traditional ones?
Yes. And in fact, that tree fall episode was what sensitized me to showers. If you camp out under a dead tree, and like this one, it's an enormous, solid dead tree that is unlikely to fall over that night, I thought that my New Guinea friends freaking out were being paranoid. But then I did the calculation. Every night that I'm sleeping in the New Guinea forest, I hear a tree fall somewhere. And yes, the chances of the dead tree falling that night were 1 in 1,000, but my New Guinea friends will spend the next 30,000 nights in the forest, and they have to make sure that their risk of the dead tree falling is less than 1 in 1,000, just as for me in the shower.
But being so cautious can also paralyze you. So how do you tell the difference between constructive paranoia and debilitating paranoia?
The New Guineans and I, we both think and then we do things. So that although, Brian, I recognize the danger of showers, I still take showers. I'm not stinking opposite you this morning. And I still go back to New Guinea, and I'm very careful there.
John in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Jared Diamond. Hello, John.
Hey, Professor. The book Sex at Dawn goes into great detail about how agriculture and property ownership came to affect the relationship between monogamy and regular society. And I wonder if you might comment on how property ownership might have something to do with this. If conflict resolution is easier in a society where the parties involved don't have property or something to take.
Interesting point, John, the role of property issues. Yes, if you've got property, it's something to consider in conflict resolution. A friend of mine was divorced and then remarried, and she's a lawyer. She said her divorce was really simple because she and her husband had no property. They were poor then. But if you got property, then the divorce negotiations go on for years. Similarly, in the case of bringing up children, in societies of nomadic hunter-gatherers where there's no property that the kid can damage, you never, never spank a kid. But once you get to be a herder with cows and gates and pastures, if the kid leaves the gate open, you lose the valuable cow, so you start spanking the kids.
But this is not an argument for poverty over prosperity, is it?
No, it's just like the question that you asked me previously. Yes, we have property, but we have to deal with it in constructive ways, not by giving up all our property.
You mentioned children. You wrote that you and many colleagues are continually struck by the self-confidence and independence of kids in traditional societies. How would you characterize that?
I'm struck by the fact, and my friends who've worked in Africa and New Guinea are struck by the fact that kids who are 5 years old already, they're self-confident, they'll come up to an adult, they'll negotiate with an adult. I had a case in New Guinea where when my porters deserted me, I had to hire some new porters, and among them there was a 10-year-old kid. Did he ask his parents for permission? No, the parents weren't around. The 10-year-old kid negotiated with me. He went off with me for a week, and then he stayed to work with me for another month. And he figured that somebody would tell him, well, your son went off with this white man. We don't know who he was, and you don't know where, and don't know how long. But you expect that a 10-year-old kid is going to be a skilled negotiator.
So how would you compare methods of child rearing that lead to that?
There are lots of differences, some of which I incorporated and my wife in our own life. You never, never spank a kid. That's one thing. You respond very quickly to the kid crying. You don't let the kid lie there and cry, but you pick up the kid within 10 seconds. An interesting difference that I never would have thought of is that when you're carrying babies, you don't push them in a baby carriage where they're horizontal. You don't carry them vertically in a pack where they look backwards. You carry your baby vertically facing forwards so the baby sees the same field of view as the person carrying the baby, and the baby feels that it's in control of the environment.
Rita in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Jared Diamond. Hello, Rita.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Yes, I wanted to talk about the previous gentleman that talked about property settlement.
Mm-hmm.
I was in southern India many, many years ago, and I remember there was this family where the matriarch had passed away and the property had to be divided. And there were about 50 people involved in that family, you know, in the entire family with about 9 kids. You know, about 30 grandkids, great-grandkids. And, you know, instead of going to a legal court, they decided to, you know, bring in somebody that everybody trusted. And that person made a settlement, and they made it according to their traditional laws, which was because it was a matriarchal community. The girls got the share for themselves, plus their children, plus their grandchildren from their daughters, and the boys just got one share. If they had gone to a legal court, then it would have been, you know, all the boys and girls getting equal, with the children and grandchildren not really getting anything.
So Rita, is this to point out the difference between a matriarchal society and a male-dominated official legal system? Or are you also talking about more about the idea of going to elders as individuals rather than some kind of professionalized system?
Well, first and foremost, yes. I mean, first and foremost, in our matriarchal society, women have more powers, children are more protected. I mean, that's a given. Secondly, in a legal system, most of the money ends up going to the lawyers and the court.
Yes.
Whereas if you take a traditional system, if it is fair, of course, that is the important thing, is that the money is not wasted on lawyers and courts, but, you know, most of the money goes to the people whom it belongs to.
Rita, for callers not familiar with India, for listeners not familiar with India, maybe people will be surprised after our previous segment on the New Delhi rape to hear you describe a matriarchal society.
Well, there are two communities in southern India, the Nayars and the Punts, which have been matriarchal forever. And in southern India, unlike New Delhi, which is in northern India, women have much more rights. Women have always been very powerful and very highly educated. So southern India and northern India have kind of very different situations in terms of rights of women.
Rita, thank you very much. Professor Diamond, any reaction?
Yes, I'd make Rita, this situation that you bring up is an interesting one, and I'd make two comments about it. In most tribal societies, which are simpler than the matriarchal community that you described, two differences are that there's not even the issue of dividing things up between the boys and the girls, because property is held by the clan, not by individuals. And the clan will assign land for people to use, but you don't divide up the land. And the other issue is that in the community that you described, the person the elder called in was the person who made a settlement. In simpler tribal societies, though, the person called in doesn't make the settlement but acts as a negotiator between the two sides, and the settler has no power but is just a way of easing the communications.
And Rita, thank you for that very interesting call. And we're almost out of time with Jared Diamond. Before you go, a couple of quick things. You know, I'm always a little wary of romanticizing traditional societies beyond their due, with attention to things like autocracy, poverty, counterproductive superstition, short lifespans, violence against women. Just before you, we did have a segment about the India rape situation. Is that a pitfall for you to watch out for when you're writing a book about what we can learn in modern societies from traditional ones?
Absolutely. It's a major pitfall. In discussing traditional societies, we have to steer away between two extremes. The one extreme is regarding traditional people as primitive brutes, barbarians who should be killed, driven off, whom there's nothing to learn. And the opposite pitfall is the one you've mentioned, romanticizing, idealizing them, considering them as peaceful paragons of virtue who are stewards of the environment. There are terrible things such as war, early death in traditional society, and there are wonderful things. Let's learn from the wonderful things and let's say thank God that we've gotten past the terrible things.
And I'm just curious, this may be completely out of your ken, but we're about to talk in the next segment about whether a newspaper publishing a map of gun owners in Westchester and Rockland counties, those who've gotten gun permits, which are a matter of public record, publishing them in a newspaper is a good thing or a violation of privacy. And I wonder if you have a take on that. Is part of what living in traditional societies – I mean, if part of what living in traditional societies is about, as you've been describing, is the closeness of community, a lack of privacy, I wonder if you'd say that this kind of disclosure – could lead to something positive or not? Or is it just so unrelated from what you study that you don't want to get involved in this?
It's a great point. Yes, the downside of the close social relations in traditional societies, which means that old people are happy, and you've always got friends and you're never lonely. The downside is that you never have privacy. And so a New Guinea friend of mine who has spent a lot of time in the U.S. and loves New Guinea is going back there says the thing that she most values in the U.S. is the privacy, that she can sit down in a cafe, read the newspaper, and not be bothered by relatives who want money or help.
That's really interesting. Jared Diamond, by the way, will be speaking tonight at the New School at 6:30. It's free, and we have a link to the event on our show page. What are you going to be doing at the New School? Do you know?
I'll be talking about the many fascinating things in my book about traditional societies.
All right. That's 6:30 tonight at the New School. Jared Diamond for free. Jared Diamond's new book is The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn. What can we learn from traditional societies? Fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, yes, we will turn to that Westchester Rockland situation and talk about journalism ethics and the Journal News gun permit map. A former editor of the Westchester Rockland paper weighs in.